God, grant me the serenity. Come on, let's sing this serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with his, per his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. Where'd you go? Where's Darren? There. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, my friend Tim, from Mission Viejo.
My name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
Thanks, Bart, for coming up here with me and introducing me, and thank you, Marcia, for asking me to speak tonight. It's always an honor to be asked to be in front of other members of Alcoholics Anonymous and share what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like now. And one more time, I didn't think about this, about what I was going to say at all, because I have a sponsor that when I was new, I asked him, you know, how do you plan, you know, when you're asked to speak? And he said, I don't plan. I just go up there and ask God to give me the words. I think he's closer to God than I am, because I don't always have those words, but I hope Bart doesn't mind me saying that he's been my sponsor and my friend for over 25 years, actually 28 years. I've been fortunate in this fellowship to have the same sponsor all that time, and if you're new, I can't stress the benefit of having a member of AA who knows about these steps and these principles and about recovery and God and all the stuff that we hear in here. You know, I was probably born an alcoholic. I was born in northeastern Ohio in the Rust Belt. I was the last of five kids, born to a dad and a mom who were both drunks. And it was a nightmare of a childhood that I didn't really realize, because when you're in the middle of a nightmare or you're used to a nightmare, it seems normal. It was a violent and this was a long time ago. There was no child services or any of that business that was going on. We just five kids that lived in this house with these two maniacs who didn't kill me. I've often said when I was about 3 years old, I said to myself, be careful, Tim, these two could kill you. on purpose or by accident. And I swear to God, I must have been three. I had a wonderful sister who was 2 years older. I was the baby of the family, and she took care of me, thank God. And I had three other brothers who were older, who were trying to make their way in life. My mom wasn't a terrible, terrible person. She just married a complete nutcase who was a drunk. He was a cripple and angry. And interesting, when I say he's an alcoholic, everybody in this room drank more than this guy ever drank. I don't know what the hell his story was, but he would nurse a beer for an hour and a half because it cost 15 cents. And I to this day, well, not he's passed away or dead. I think about the way he drank and concluded he probably acted drunk. It probably gave him the courage to be as rage-filled and angry as he was, because I never really saw him drink as much as we drank. But at any rate, I lived with these people. I went to Catholic school from first grade through sixth grade. And, you know, those people in that place, it was called St. Sebastian's. It was the high-end Catholic church in shithole Ohio. And, you know, I failed first grade. I flunked first grade. So did my sister and so did my brother Dave. It became, you know, the tradition as you go east is interesting. These nuns, I didn't know I was an alcoholic then, but I knew I was different. I was different than, separate than, scared, you know, and God, my wife goes to a Bible study, and I accompanied her once, and the minister, you know, I love religious people, they're fine, but they're so nice. Oh, hi, it's so good to see you. How are you? You know, and he did that, and it reminded me when I was in second grade that Sister Mary Elizabeth, in a classroom about like this, and for those of you who know about discipline and, you know, if there's any young people in here, God love you, I mean, you probably won't believe any of this, but they would just beat the shit out of you without no ramifications. I saw Sister Mary Elizabeth pick up Jimmy Hampton by his ear, and part of his ear came off, and blood is coming down. She didn't blink an eyelash. Go to the nurse, you know. But I was used to that. And I sat in the back of the room and those things. But I remember Sister Mary Elizabeth going through religion class, which seemed to be every class. You know, math was religion. You know, geography was religion. You know, and she said, well, now, children, you know, the sky and the mountains and all of the fish in the sea and all of the animals and all of the plants are here, given to you by God for man. And I remember sitting there in second grade thinking, man, that sounds awfully convenient to me. So the Catholic religion kind of lost me there because I thought they kind of set things up for themselves. So I stayed in that school after I flunked first grade. And by then, my brother Ron and Mike were stealing cars and drinking and getting caught and going to the detention home. My brother Dave was the baddest guy in town. And a fighter, which I'm not. And I asked a friend of his once why Dave was such a tough guy. He's the next brother to me. I said, why is everybody so afraid of Dave? And Paul said, you don't know? And I said, no, you know, he's not that great a fighter. He said, no, he's not that great a fighter. But everybody knows, if you're in a fight with Dave, he'll die before he gives up. And he's an alcoholic like me. And it was a crazy family. I didn't know it was crazy, thank God. I got in trouble a lot when I was 12 and 13 years old. 11, 12, 10, 11, 9, 10, 11, 12, 8, 9, 10, 11. You know, I liked to break windows. You know, I did everything. You know, I just did shit, man. I was just a mischievous son of a bitch. You know, the Ohio Edison was the electric company, like here at SCE, and they had this beautiful sign that said, "Welcome to Ohio Edison." It was about half a mile from our house, and they had these two spotlights that showed the sign at night. And I would go ice skating in the wintertime, and every night that I came home from ice skating, I would punch my skates through those two spotlights. Every night, you know, and it never dawned on me that sooner or later somebody was going to get pissed about this, and they were waiting for me there when I punched my skates through there when I was about 11, and they took me to the detention home, and I was with Jimmy Zazo. I love these names, Jimmy Zazo, you know, I don't know whether it was Russian or Polish or whatever, but anyway, they were a similar family to mine, but they had more money, and they took his detention home, and Jimmy Zazo's dad came and got him, you know, that in an hour. I was there a month. And, you know, it was kind of shitty, and I didn't expect my dad. I could hear the cops. By then, I'd heard people whispering behind my back, the nuns and the teachers and neighbors. And, you know, I was the kid that the moms all said, yeah, well, Timmy, you can come over to our house and play. But nobody's coming to your house to play. And so I knew when I was 5, 6 years old that things weren't all real good at 1619 Hartman Avenue. It's funny, as you get old, you remember that shit. That was 50-plus years ago. So I wound up in the detention home on this thing. I heard the cops kind of whispering about, Jesus, if I'd have known his parents weren't coming, I wouldn't have fucking arrested him. But, so I kind of knew that I was an unusual kid. And they took me to the detention home where, as I said, I spent a month. And my two older brothers, by then, they were in their 20s, my oldest brothers. And I guess they got together and said, we got to do something, you know. And the one said, well, I'll take Joanne and you take Timmy. I say Timmy because when you're the baby of the family and your name is Tim, you will be Timmy for the rest of your life. My sponsor calls me Timmy. And I think that's from South Park, but Timmy. So at any rate, behind my back, I had a wonderful priest. I shouldn't say anything bad about Catholics, because there was a priest named Father Paul Selle from St. Mary St. Vincent's. And any basketball fans probably know that that's where LeBron James went to high school, St. Mary St. Vincent's. And Paul Selle worked with kids who are in trouble. And he took me, it was a lot like AA meetings. He would take me to these every evening, or three times a week or whatever. He would take me to, I guess what they would be group homes today, you know, places where they took bad boys. And he would take me with him, and they had a meeting. It was not like this, but there were some similarities. They were trying to get these kids to stop shooting each other or knifing each other or robbing banks or whatever they were doing. I wasn't doing those things yet. So I went with this guy, and he loved me. I liked him. You know, he gave me candy bars. He cared about me, and I was so frightened and so terrified of everything that I don't know if I ever liked him or not until later, until he died. He was long gone, dead before I realized how much he had done for me. And he got together with my brothers, and I wound up in New York City with my brother Mike. He was 22 and I was 12. And again, about child services and all that, I remember him saying, "Look, you know, don't cause any trouble because nobody knows you're here." You know, and I was able to get into schools and sign the paperwork and get through that stuff. And my brother had a couple of roommates. Some of them were celebrities later on, writers and actors and stuff like that. And they patted me on the head, and I did all the dishes and all the laundry and stuff like that, which I still do today. And I was the mascot of 404 East 75th Street. And this 2.5-room apartment where we had anywhere from 3 to 8 guys living any given time. And in those days, we called them stewardesses, and they were coming and going all the time. Because these were all young, good-looking guys. I was a kid. I won't get into the graphics of what happened in some of those situations. There were some very nice women who liked little boys. And that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. And I didn't drink any alcohol, and it was about that time, 14, 15, we moved out to California. My brother got a job as a manager of a nightclub, and we moved to West Hollywood. And I went to Hollywood High School. And the dope was a big deal. Everybody smoked marijuana except me. And my brother was... just a great guy that took his little brother in, and he would tell me what to do once or twice a week, max. And I did it. And I've always wondered about it. I have two daughters today. I know nothing about being a father or a parent other than responsibility and economics, because they're both daughters. But at any rate... my brother would say, you know, there's 10 bucks here in the drawer, you get 10 bucks a week, you take more than 10 bucks a week, I'll kill you. And everything was like that. You know, it was like Cool Hand Luke. You know, take the spoon, you turn the spoon in, you don't turn the spoon in, you spend a night in the box. So I did that pretty well. And I had good friends at Hollywood High School, like guys do when we're teenagers. And they were all sneaking around and doing shit and smoking dope and shit. I didn't know then that... I didn't have anything to rebel against, so I didn't. And I lived with my brother for a while, and then he met a girl. God, it was great. He met this wonderful Swedish gal who lived upstairs in an apartment, and he sat me down, and I was 17, and I was still in high school, and he said, "You know Christine upstairs?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm going to ask her to marry me. She don't like you. You got to move." So I did. I moved to Redondo Beach and finished high school at Redondo Beach Union High School. And I lived in a garage apartment that cost 10 bucks a week. And I started drinking Gallo Vin Rosé. Vin Rosé. And I had an experience with Gallo Vin Rosé where I never drank red wine again. And I got drunk. I didn't know then what I later learned, and that is that, you know, I've never wanted a drink in my life. I've never wanted a drug in my life. I want to get drunk. I want to change the way I feel. When I first heard that, I heard a speaker at South Coast Hospital where I wound up in 1984. And he was a speaker, a guy not unlike me, and he started his speech. He said, I've never wanted a drink or a drug in my life. All I want to do is get drunk and drink into oblivion. And I was new, and I was sitting somewhere out there, and that was my first honest understanding of what my malady was. And I began to think about the times that I drank. And I thought, I don't think I've never had a drink in my life. I've never had a beer. I remember I had a client, I'm skipping some, but I got involved in the television motion picture industry, and I was an agent, and I represented some people. And I remember being invited to dinner at an important client's house, and I knew him pretty well, and I was meeting his wife for the second or third time. They had a nice house in Beverly Hills and so on. And I got to the house, and Judy was her first name. She said, oh, Tim, I'm really glad that you came to dinner, but you like to drink, and we don't have any alcohol in our home. And I said, oh, that's okay. And I turned around, got in the car, drove to a liquor store, bought a bottle of Johnny Walker Black, two bottles of soda, 3 6-packs of beer, something like that, and two bottles of wine. And I came back 10 minutes later, and her mouth is down to here. And I didn't know then. I didn't know until I got sober how inappropriate that behavior was. I thought she was saying, will you go to the store and get some booze? That is not what she said. So I dicked around at Redondo Beach Union High School with some people and began to understand that I was more different now than I was back in Ohio. Everybody had parents, and everybody had hope, and everybody had stuff, and I didn't have anything. So I went to work at this stupid grocery store, bagging groceries, living by myself in Redondo Beach, and it wasn't 3 months. And the manager really liked me, and he said, if you go down to Buena Park and take this test, we'll put you through college, and you'll be on a management training program. I had no idea what he was talking about. But it was, they're out of business now. I'll tell you later why. But at any rate, that was Lucky Stores Incorporated. And in 1965, they were the fastest growing retail chain in the country. They were opening 3 stores a week in California. So I went down to Buena Park and I took this test, and it must have been 2 months later that the vice president or somebody came out and said, this is the deal. You go to USC, we pay your way, we give you this thing, you work 20 hours a week, you go to school 20 hours a week. And I can't even mimic what I was like. I don't know what the hell I was doing. But I said, yeah, okay. And I had no plan. The deal was, you go to school 20 hours a week and you work 20 hours a week. Well, you go to school 20 hours a week and you work 60 hours a week. So the only thing left to do was to drink. And I have the keys to a grocery store that has a huge liquor department. And I started to drink alcoholically. But, I'm 19, 20 years old. And for those of you who are that age, who are in this room, which I don't understand, but I'm really glad you're here, the resilience of youth, I think about that today. What I was able to do to this body from 18 to 20-something is amazing to me. I could drink and drink and drink and drink and drink and never black out, drive fine. Remember, I drive better when I'm drunk. I'm more alert. I pay more attention. So I did that. I worked at Lucky Stores. I went to school. The day I got through it, I drank and got drunk and chased girls as much as I could. And life was not getting any better. But I was able to excel at this company because I'm an alcoholic. It says it in the big book that we are overachievers. I knew what to say. I didn't believe any of it. But, I had the vice presidents and all those guys that say, see, that, like what Tim said. That's, I don't know what the hell I said. It just sounded good. The customer's always right. I mean, you know, it's not real complicated. And there's a lot of dumb shits in that business anyway. But at any rate, so they promoted me to manager, and I managed and opened a whole bunch of stores. I opened the Granada Hills, the Woodland Hills, Gemco. I went to Texas and opened 5 Memcos. I don't know if anybody remembers those. But they were big stores in Texas. And what I learned was I had access to as much alcohol as I wanted whenever I wanted it, no matter what. It wasn't legal, but I'm the only, you know, you just go open the bottle and you drink it, you know. I have morals today, but I didn't have any morality over that. You know, my picture was on the thing. I'm the manager. It's my store, like that picture back there. And it was, I had no, I didn't even sneak. I did feel bad when we'd catch employees stealing. And I would have, so they had all kinds of, people in the grocery business are obsessed with shoplifters and catching employees stealing shit. There's a lady back here that reminds me of this woman, Jan, who was a checker for us. And Jan had a deal where her friends or her mother or her daughters or whatever, they would come through her check stand. And she'd knock out $700-$800 for the groceries, and the bill would be about $6.47, which is pretty easy to do. I saw her do that and then began to do it myself. I hope nobody's here from Lucky Stores. So in the middle of this, I have no time. I'm going to school. They promoted me to this management thing, and I get my degree, and now they promoted me again. And I met this woman who had 2 kids, of course, and she let me sleep with her all the time. And so I married her, you know. And then she started to come to the store through the check stands. I came home when I wanted to, and I stayed away the rest of the time. And she was pretty angry with me. I married a woman who was older than me. I'm friends with her today, and now I know how old she is. And, you know, it was one of those things. I was 19, she was 40. No, not that bad. I shouldn't say that. It doesn't matter what her name is. But she was about 27, 28, you know. And she had these 2 kids, and one was a lovely daughter, Lisa, who was near my age, and this little boy, Drew. And I played dad. I'm just rattling on here, but I'm telling you what a nutcase I was. Anyway, I married this woman, and we buy this house up in La Cañada, which is near the Glendale stores, and I'm now a supervisor of all these stores that I have the keys to, that I go into when we're closed, and take whatever I want. I had a bar, I had a thing for scotch, I had every kind of scotch, and backup bottle. It looked like a bar. A real bar in a big place. And my wife didn't drink much. I don't think Bonnie drank at all. And I would get drunk every night and go to school, work the next day. And I'm back to the resiliency of youth. I didn't have hangovers to speak of. I didn't have any of the alcoholic, pitiful, and incomprehensible demoralization that I was later to experience. I didn't think I was doing well. I had that, what I learned in AA is impending doom in this marriage with this woman, and everything was temporary in my life up until that point. Everything was going to the next spot on the checkerboard of life. And one day I came, Saturday I was going to go play touch football with some guys from my brother's business. My brother was in the television motion picture industry, which is what I wanted to do anyway. And they were going to play touch football over at Brentwood Park or something. And she said something to the effect of, you know, you're not going. And the next thing was something about mowing the lawn. And I moved out that day. And a week later she said, I'm going to have a baby. And, of course, she had a baby. And we struggled with all that divorce and custody and child support and all that calamity that I'm pretty knowledgeable about with divorce and child custody and court. So I divorced that woman and moved to the Hollywood Hills with some people. And it was during, God, by then we were into the heavy Vietnam and hippie movement and all that in the late 60s. And I still didn't smoke a lot of dope, but I did drink. I drank a lot. And because I was young, I was able to drink. I didn't. DUIs weren't a big deal. Maybe they were. I don't know. But I didn't have any problem with the cops in the 60s and even into the 70s. I kept marrying people and getting drunk. And I finally left Lucky Stores Incorporated. It's a long story. They never really caught me, but they damn near caught me. And by then I was embezzling. My ninth step could never be fulfilled, is all I can say. I pay all my bills at the grocery store today, and I take the grocery basket back into the store, and I'm nice to all those people. It's kind of a living amends. But I was able to do what I wanted to do, and that's become a talent agent. So I went to work at the William Morris Talent Agency, which is, at that time was the largest agency in the world, and I got to do what I wanted to do, because I love movies, and I love TV, and I love that lifestyle. I was introduced to that in New York City with actors and writers and directors, and I got real involved in that. And I remember, like it was yesterday, the first lunch that I remember having at Joe Allen's on 3rd Street. And they said, what do you want? And so on. I said, I'll have an iced tea. And the agent that I was with, he said, iced tea? I said, fuck it, man, have a martini. And I went, oh, God, I've died and gone to heaven. So I started to drink at lunch. And I drank at lunch and never stopped as time went by. And I was pretty successful in that industry. And like most alcoholics, once I was with the agency for a couple of years and I was trained and got well known or somewhat known, I thought, well, I could do this myself. I'm my own agency. I'll compete with one. I'll steal all their clients. So I opened my own agency and got married again. To a wonderful gal. She was a producer of commercials from a great family right down the street from O.J. and Nicole in Brentwood. Really, really. It's another part of the story. But at any rate, we had what looked like a real nice life on the outside. We had a nice condominium in Beverly Hills. She had a BMW. I had a Corvette. And I was introduced to another drug, cocaine. And what I learned about cocaine, even though this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, was cocaine would enable me to drink more alcohol. The first time I did it was at a party, and I was drunk. By now, I'm probably 27, 28 years old, feeling 50, and because I'm getting drunk every day. And in the business I was in, I was interested to hear John talk about being a periodic and drinking on the weekends. I drank every day without any interruption. I would start with Bloody Marys at 9 o'clock in the morning at Nibbler's, which was at the ground floor of the William Morris offices, and drink Bloody Marys from 9 to 11 and talk about movies and TV and scripts and shit and drink and drink and drink. And when it stopped working at the right time, I believe that there's a power greater than myself in my sober life. But there's a power greater than myself in my drunken life, too, because somebody introduced me to this white powder cocaine when I was so drunk I could barely walk. And he said, here, do a little bit of this. So I snorted some of this stuff, and I did it the way he told me to do it. And that was a whole process of behavior and stuff in your nose and all. I mean, the idea of doing it the first time is really disgusting. You put this thing up your nose and you. And I'm a wuss when it comes to anything physical. I don't want anybody touching me. I don't want any food that I don't know about. And so, but I did this, and I was sober in about 30 seconds. And I went, gee, yeah, this is really good. How much is this stuff? And he said, oh, it's nothing, man. You have as much as you want. I mean, it was right out of an ad for how to be a dope addict. So $30,000 later and 6 months later, I'm driving down 6th Street from, where did I live then? From Robertson to Vermont. Everything to do with my dope life was in Watts, Vermont, East L.A., driving an orange Corvette with my name on the license plate, looking the way I look. But I had a client who was an ex-football player and an African-American, and he would go with me to buy this dope. And I made that trip 3, 4, 5 times a day. I had a wonderful dope dealer. I could call him today. He's still doing what he's doing. He's a very successful dope dealer. He's from another country, intelligent guy. And he said to me more than once, why don't you just buy a quarter? You know, it's 5 o'clock in the morning. I told you you'd run out. Anyway, so I did that for some time. And my life was, I married this wonderful Jewish girl whose parents had a lot of money, or they did when I met them. They didn't have so much after they met me. My dad used to use the term chiseler. Bart and I talk about it all the time. I was a chiseler. God, I had every story. I had this wonderful father-in-law who believed this scheme that I had about a picture. And he went back to his Brentwood bedroom and opened up his Brentwood bedroom safe and handed me $25,000 to start, at which time me and his daughter got in our car, drove 5 miles and spent it all on dope, and went back the next week and so on. It's another 9th step that is difficult to go forward with, but by then I was starting to I was really on the downward spiral. I needed to drink. I needed to drink alcohol. I got pulled over for what should have been a DUI at Pico and La Cienega in about 1978. And these two cops, I was drunk. And these two cops pulled me over and I get out of the car and so on. And at that time, they part of the sobriety test was saying the ABCs. I was really drunk. And I said, I didn't know about the ABCs. So I said, well, you know, I never really have said the ABCs, but I can sing them. And the cop said, would you like to sing them for us now? So I gave him this. There was a famous TV show, cop show, that was on the air at the time. And I knew the guy in the show. And I told him, I'm this guy's agent. And they said, really, are you? And I knew, he's a cop. I mean, what's he know? So I had enough bullshit that they let me go. But I'll never forget this. They took me down to the Santa Monica police station. I blew a .09. And in those days, .10 was the thing. And .09, between 06 and 09, it's up to the cop. So I blew 09, and I asked the one cop, I said, what do you think he's going to do? And he said, what do you think he's going to do? Because the guy loved me. He loved the cop star TV show stories that I was making up. And he did let me go. So they drive me back to my car. And as I get to my car, the other guy said, well, you know, drive safely. And the other cop looked at me and he said, there's something about you that's telling me you are totally full of shit. But they let me go. But I wasn't really happy about it. I was at the point of being pitiful and incomprehensibly demoralized. I'd lost 2 or 3 wives by then. I loved them all, or some of them. And I was going nowhere, and I was, getting drunk every night. Sunset Boulevard from Gazzari's to Whiskey down to every place. And that's what I did. I drank and used. Then I did get a DUI. There was a place called the 9000 at the end of Sunset, right at the turn, and there was a big party in there, and I'm also an ignorant dope addict and alcoholic. I don't know the names of everything, and this waitress asked me, there was a group there that we represented, and I was with some other people, whatever, and somebody said something about Long Island iced tea, and I don't know if that's still a popular drink. But it's a whole bunch of alcohol and nothing else. And I downed 4 of those real fast. And I was at the end of my drinking. And I went out to get my car, and the kid gave me my car, and I could barely walk. And I got in the car, and my head just hit the steering wheel, and I went about somewhere between 200 and 900 yards and hit a brick wall. I've never really been pulled over and given a DUI. I've been scraped off a highway, taken to the hospital, and then given a DUI, which there's some pride in that. I wasn't really caught. I made it easy for him. I wrecked a bunch of cars. Well, five cars, and I hurt myself, and I wound up in the hospital, and I had a splenectomy and a collapsed lung, and you know, I got banged up in the head and concussions and shit. But you can't kill a good alcoholic. I mean, I do read where we do. Some of us bite the dust, but a lot of us live through it where we probably oughtn't. So I got taken to L.A. County Jail at my bottom, and I wound up in front of a judge in Beverly Hills. And I just didn't get it. You know, I came in there, and he asked me a lot of questions. I had probably six or seven or warrants from tickets that I hadn't paid. And he said, what about this stop sign? He was trying to clear the docket to get to my DUI. And he said, what about this stop sign at Oakhurst and Wilshire? And I said, no, I didn't do that. He said, no, all you have to do is just plead guilty, and we'll throw away the failure to... I said, no, I didn't do that. And I... You know, and he's rolling his eyes, and I'm just not getting it. And he's really getting pissed off. And at one point, I'm trying to make this quick, but it was the turning point for me in my alcoholism and my inability to live life. At one point, he said to the bailiff, he said, what's the longest period of time between now and the next court date for Mr. Carr, that's my lesson, and the highest bail? And he said, well, 100 days and $50,000 for a misdemeanor DUI. And he said, okay, that's what it'll be, $50,000 bail, no 10%, because he wanted me to go to jail. And I had an attorney at that time that said that. He said, well, you can bail out if you want. I said, well, you know, fine. He said, no, it's $50,000. It's not, you can't use a bail because you pissed him off. And so I went to L.A. County Jail, and on a bus, with the kind of men that are on the bus going to L.A. County Jail. I was going where I belonged, but, I was 35 years old. And I looked around this bus, and, I was the oldest guy on it, and they were all, some real terrible characters. And it wasn't more than 2 or 3 hours later that I was in a room about where those three chairs are, with seven African-American boys. There were 18, 19, and two cops. They're all 5'7" at L.A. County Jail. All the cops are small. But they have all the shit that they wear and stuff. They look big. And we're naked, and we're being searched. And I'm standing there saying, this is not what I had in mind. So I did that jail. I'm going to say it's a terrible place, but I'll digress or go forward for a minute. When I got to my first AA meetings, and I still had some destruction of the past, I walked up to a member of AA, not like any of you men who've been sober for a while, and I said that if I don't do this and that and this and that, I'm going to really be in trouble. And he said, well, what kind of trouble? And I said, well, I could go to jail. And he said, really? I said, yeah. I said, you ever been to jail? I said, yeah. He said, how was that? I said, not bad. He said, there you go. And that was my introduction to the men in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I went to jail. I was there for 103 days, and I didn't know what was going to happen with my life. John talked about suicide. I thought a lot about that. But I don't like to hurt myself. I don't like messes. I mean, I got a litany of shit and stuff to not do that. And I got out of L.A. County. I went back in front of that judge, and he ordered me to find a drug and alcohol treatment program or be in L.A. County jail for a year. That motivated me to find a hospital program or some other program. And they were starting to come in to be the care units, and Genesis is where I wound up. But the care unit, even Schick, if you remember, Schick had those great commercials for a couple of two-day follow-ups, So I had the judge said, you got to find your own drug rehab, and I have to accept it, and you have to pay for it. So I found, I found Capo by the Sea was the first place that I interviewed. And there was I've got his name written down. There was the head of the program, the psychiatrist in the program, whoever it was, Dr. Joe Wonderful. And he met with me in a little private area. lobby, I think. And I was sitting there. I mean, I didn't have a clue about alcoholism. I did not think that my problem was alcohol. I did not think that I had a problem with alcohol. But I was doing what they told me to do. And I sat there with this guy, and I can't do him. He was too smart. I had my act with me, saying, well, I have to find a rehab program, and I chose yours because somebody recommended it, and so on. And he looked at me, and I can't do him, but I love acting in movies and shit, so I wish I could do that, but I can't. But he looked at me, and he said, I know what you're feeling. And he drew a circle. And he went through, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralized, not good enough, not measuring up. By now, I'm crying. I hadn't cried. I don't know, and I don't remember the time before that I cried. I mean, this guy had me in tears in 30 seconds after sitting with me. And he didn't blink an eyelash. He said, yeah, I know, you know, you're a candidate, you know, for this, but you'll be better off at Genesis at South Coast. We're more expensive, and they do a better job. He said, so it's a God thing. So I went up, and I interviewed at Genesis, and for the same reasons. I was just trying to get the monkey off my back. I was not trying to get sober or get well or fix myself. I was just trying to do what the court told me to do so I could get them off my back. And I wound up in the Genesis program, and I met wonderful Cindy A., who's with us here tonight. Shit, here we go. And Lau and the people that managed that fifth floor at the South Coast Hospital. And God, it was... I went straight there. I won't bore you with the rest of the jail and the judge, but he made sure that I went into Genesis sober. Actually, when I went in with my presentation, I'll go to South Coast Hospital Genesis program. Here's my insurance. I'm paying for it and so on. And he said, okay, I accept this, but you will go into this program sober. 60 days, L.A. County Jail. And it was great, because I started to walk out the room, and he said, wait a minute. And he said, I know you're tight. You'll figure some way out of there before 60 days. So I'm going to put in the order that you be in that hospital 24 hours after you get out of this jail. So I wound up in Genesis, August 19th, 1984. And I was introduced to the recovery of alcoholism. I was introduced to the Big Book. Actually, God, what was the guy's name that owned the Laguna Hotel? He passed away. The guy that used to come up to the fifth floor and work with other drunks. He came into my room. I was in the detox room. And he sat down on my bed and he said, you don't have to think about anything anymore. Read this. And he handed me the Big Book. And I did read it. I read the Jaywalker was the first thing I read. And that was the second time I started crying. I've got to get to that's what happened. I was able to go to AA meetings every morning in that hospital program at St. Catherine's in Laguna. You know, I grasped onto this program and the program of recovery like no other gift I've ever received. I met my sponsor within a month, and my life began to turn around because I believed in this recovery program and this fellowship. The fellowship is what I think got me sober, and the fellowship is what keeps me sober. You know, to go from the dregs of where I put myself in 1984 to the glorious life that I've been given is unexplainable. I don't have the words. I did everything that was suggested. I worked with my sponsor. I didn't work the steps in any particular time period. I don't think I did my fourth step for 2 years. I worked the first three. Turning my will and my power of my life over to God. And I understood that I was an alcoholic. And as they said, the compulsion, the desire to drink was lifted. I never believed that for a second when I heard it. But walking out of St. Catherine's after about 8 weeks, I stopped on the wood floor and said, what is that feeling that I have? And And I recognized it, and the feeling was hope. And I realized and recognized I didn't want to drink. I don't know the last time I wanted to drink. So I threw myself into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and going to meetings and being with other men in the program. And I mean men. I wasn't allowed to talk to women in the beginning. I had too much baggage. And for anybody who's new, if I have any message, it's about the fellowship. It's about surrounding yourself with as many members of Alcoholics Anonymous as you can find. I've been insulted when I was new. I was told that I didn't know how to love. I was told I didn't know how to be a friend. I was told I didn't know how to live. And I accepted it. I never hit anybody or got mad. I believed them. And they told me, we will teach you how to live here. We will teach you how to love. And we'll teach you how to be a friend. And we'll teach you how to be all of the things that you need to be and that you want to be. And now it's 27 years later, and my life has been filled with joy. I have wonderful friends, wonderful fellowship, a wonderful wife. I don't have any of that calamity and nightmare lifestyle that I came from. I get to look forward to going to meetings and seeing you as we trudge the road to happy destiny. I love that John, 26 years, congratulations, that talked about going to meetings. I talk to people who don't go, and I don't know anything about that. I don't know how to judge it or anything else. The idea of giving up this fellowship and these relationships and this recovery and these gifts, and the opportunity to meet new people and work with new people, is not in my world. I want to remain a member of AA, and I go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. I talk to my sponsor every day, and 5 or 7 or 10 other alcoholics every day, and it's just fun. You know, it doesn't feel like recovery. It feels like living life. Am I done? Okay. I thank you all for listening. I hope somebody got something out of this. Thank you.